Hi there and welcome to the New Health Club podcast. Psychedelics are experiencing a renaissance these days, developing into a tool to help us go through life. But what are LSD, magic mushrooms, psilocybin, MDMA or ketamine are exactly doing for our mental health, personal progress or even optimization? Will they change our lifestyles and lives forever? I'm sure they will. On the New Health Club podcast, I talk to real innovators, leaders and disruptors from the emerging world of psychedelics. Enjoy. This podcast deals with drugs. Drugs are dangerous. Furthermore, the use and or trade of drugs can be punishable by law. Please keep this in mind. This podcast is not suitable for people under the age of 18. Hello and welcome to a new episode of the New Health Club podcast. Dr. Bronner is the top-selling soap in the US natural marketplace. They only use the purest organic and fair trade ingredients. They are third generation of Jewish soap makers from Heilbronn. I always bought the soap at Trader Joe's in California and I loved it very much. Little did I know about the CEO or the Cosmic Engagement Officer, David Bronner, who I met in Nuremberg a few weeks ago. I have to say, David is an awesome cat. This is how he describes people he likes a lot. We forgot to take a selfie since our topic was so exciting. Well, we talked psychedelics and how a company is run by a cosmic engagement officer, someone with psychedelic experience and lifestyle. And also what that could mean for a business plan or a company in general in the future. Dr. Bronner is involved in a new psychedelic world, is supporting MAPS, where David sits on the board, and there's a Dr. Bronner $1 million pledge and unity support of the psilocybin therapy and drug addiction treatment and recovery acts in Oregon and decriminalize nature campaigns around the U.S. In this podcast, we also talk about David's visit in Heilbronn. He showed me pictures of stumble stones from his Jewish ancestors killed in Theresienstadt and Auschwitz. And we are talking about if Holocaust trauma could be cured with the help of psychedelics. So please listen to David and his Dr. Bronner journey. Well, thank you so much for meeting the New Health Club podcast in this Twin Peaks like surrounding today in Nuremberg. So this is David Bronner. We're very excited to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I mean, everybody knows the soap for sure, but it's just a little part of your activities. So maybe you introduce yourself. What is your relation to the current psychedelic renaissance?
Sure. So I'm Cosmic Engagement Officer, CEO at Dr. Bronner's. Well, I mean, I guess I'm on the board of MAPS. I passionately believe in the integration of psychedelic and plant medicine allies in a global culture is necessary for us to heal up our traumas, our depression, addictions, and fundamental disconnection from nature and each other. And wake up and care about the huge environmental and social problems we're facing. So I guess my origin story was we were just in Amsterdam, where I traveled after college. And in college, I guess I'll just back all the way up to my granddad, Dr. Bronner, was himself a third-generation German-Jewish soap maker. He came up in the guild system of the time. And his grandfather first began manufacturing soap in Laupheim in the basement in 1858, also named Emmanuel. So by the time my granddad came of age, his dad and two uncles were running, had founded a big factory in Heilbronn and were producing, I think, most of the liquid soap that was in public washrooms and up in the Zeppelins and really, really big enterprise. And my granddad was a very intense guy, and he was very Zionist, and just had a lot of newfangled ideas about soap making, and was clashing with his dad and uncles all the time. So he was like, you know, stop mixing politics and soap, you know, like, you know, it's just, and more out of the generational conflict than anything about the rising tide of fascism. In 1929, he He emigrated to the U.S., so the eventual dimensions of Hitler and Nazism were not yet apparent. It was more of a generational clash. And he became a consultant to the U.S. soap industry and was helping launch products and design factories and stuff like that. He married a woman, Paula, my dad's mom, had three kids in his time, and is also becoming increasingly desperate to get his family out of Germany. His two sisters got out. Lottie, his younger sister, got out at the age of 21 and 36 and ended up in kibbutz and then Palestine and now Israel. And Louisa got out at 38 and came to the U.S. and eventually became a professor of German at UMass Boston, but first was a chemist and actually developed a waterproofing compound for the American GIs, paratroopers into the Korean War. We got no credit and discussed quit and became a PhD German literature. She just loved German culture, but just wrote in her poetry this the tragedy and enormity of this culture just ripped her apart, her family, everything apart. Wrote in Hebrew and German and English, just very, very powerful. And shared my granddad, and she was all about uniting the humanities and science and sort of the deep heart and love at the heart of existence. And that was definitely what my granddad was all about. So Dr. Bronner with the, so their parents that tried to get him out. And Louisa, I just recently found this out reading Garrow's, our German-American ace who runs our agricultural programs, grew up in Cologne, has really been helpful in introducing us to our history, our German Jewish history. And he's writing a book. And I just found out that Louisa had actually had worked with her parents to get them papers, and they were ready to emigrate to America. But then Germany and America declared war and the borders were closed. But like a lot of the Jews, they thought they were going to ride out the madness. They're in industry, in a semi-privileged position, but stayed till it was too late. The factory was Aryanized in 1939, and they were deported and killed in 42 and 44.
In Auschwitz?
Auschwitz and Theresienstadt. I think Bertolt and Franziska, I think Bertolt got sick in Theresienstadt. All the different ways Jews were killed or whatever. But anyway, so the enormity of this tragedy, and also my granddad's wife got really sick and died when my dad was two. So granddad's going through this immense personal tragedy, and his answer to this was that, was to basically realize that the next Holocaust in the nuclear-armed world, if we don't realize our transcendent unity across religious and ethnic divides, and that all the faith traditions are at their best pointing at the same divine source, and every person prays to God in his or her own language, and there's no language she doesn't understand, like that message of the one true religion of love at the heart of these faiths, but when they take themselves literally and fundamentalist, that's when it becomes a disaster, and they make idols out of their beliefs, and that closes down access to the source. But when you're open, and it's all one, and that's what we're all about. And he was passionate on his mission to promote this all one vision, and went around the country lecturing on the all one peace plan.
Your grandfather, was
And this is McCarthy era Cold War. He's just urgently like, we need to come together. We need to realize our transcendent unity, and found and was basically selling his soaps on the side. As he's going around lecturing, and realizes word gets out that this is really good soap. So people start coming to hear him speak, not to hear him speak, but to just get the soap and leave. So that's when he downloaded his philosophy on the label of our soaps. So our soaps are like really famous for the all-one philosophy that is on every bottle.
That's still on a bottle today, right?
It's a memorial to him, it's the all-one God. And the company, he founded a religion, basically. It was the all-one God faith, which is still our corporate name, all-one God faith. We do business as Dr. Bronner's. But he felt the soap was, or he looked at the soap more to sell a label than the label to sell the soap. But he was an early ecological pioneer. He brought the kind of German green ethic with him. A lot of the American kind of health food movement, eco movement, there was a lot of German influence, and certainly the green, just that whole green ethic, my granddad early on saw the, you know, in the post-World War era, this like turn to petrochemicals and synthetic fertilizers and plastics and, you know, just this wholesale turn to fossil fuel dependent economy. And he saw the dangers of that and, you know, promoted what was somewhat out of fashion, but his family soap, which was concentrated, versatile, biodegradable. And with the counterculture in the 60s that, you know, came up, you know, the era of like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and the rising, you know, awareness of this, you know, ecocide, this ecological disaster on the earth, like a comet's hitting it. And then this war machine that won't stop. And, you know, this whole generation, you know, basically dropped out of the dominant kind of paradigm and, you know, trying to create an alternative world, you know, a sustainable peace and love. And that's when our soap really caught fire. So my granddad's had this, you know, biodegradable soap. You wash your hair, your dishes, your dog, other side of the river, not worry about it. So the soaps became the iconic kind of product of the time, along with VW buses. And yeah, so it just, so, you know, so I came up, you know, well, so my granddad going off to save the world wasn't the best father. And he put his, you know, he'd lost his wife. He put his kids basically came up in a series of foster homes, which he financially supported. He checked in, but wasn't present. And my dad had a lot of anger towards my granddad. And so my dad went to the Navy, came out after 8 years and went to work for my granddad, though, and oversaw and would go and rent out a reactor in Los Angeles at a chemical specialty manufacturing firm and make the soap for my granddad. But when it was just a very difficult relationship. And when my granddad moved down to San Diego, my dad stayed up in L.A., to oversee the soap manufacturer, but he became the head of that operation. So I grew up, me and my brother, Mike, who's, we're 50-50 now at Bronner's, and it's a totally family enterprise. We grew up working for my dad, and my dad developed, among other things, firefighting foam for structure and forest fires. And when you see foam on a big forest fire, which is really good in a low visibility situation, you can see where the water drops, and it looks like a blizzard hit it. Then my dad's like, wow, this looks like a blizzard. So then he developed a version for Hollywood, a fake snow. So me and my brother grew up blasting foam on the world and each other, and it's a super ecstatic, beautiful, beautiful experience. In a way, it's an avatar of psychedelic experience, but well, I guess we get to that.
Yeah. But I mean, so you kind of, I'm not going to say like pick up where your grandfather left a little bit, but you're also kind of very outspoken about, for example, decriminalization of mushrooms in California. I mean, this is like decriminalized California.
Okay, so fast forward, I came up, my dad rejected my grand, you know, he reacted against the cosmic trip of my granddad. He associated that as an escape, and my dad was all about family and community and just showing up and you know, being practical about what you can do, and just was the most mega example to both me and my brother as far as a moral, upright, engaged. He didn't, you know, he was just an amazing, amazing, amazing man. But, you know, and when I would hang out with my granddad, you know, my granddad was just 24/7 coming from the mountaintop on this all one, you know, we must unite this spaceship Earth. You know, we're all one or none. And it was just selling all over our heads. And I just didn't get it. And, you know, and I was raised Protestant, although I said the Shema in Hebrew and English as well with my Christian prayers. But by the time I was 13, I'm like, I rejected my faith. I was like, if God so loved the world, why'd he send his only son to this one spot? What about the Chinese? What about all the other planets? But then in college, I was a biology major, and I was kind of getting discontent with this kind of scientific reductionistic worldview that consciousness is just, you know, an adaptive trait, not that interesting, beyond an evolutionarily whatever advantageous trait to have. I was like, well, that's kind of insufficient. And I was kind of dropped out of alcohol culture too, starting to smoke a lot of cannabis and just realizing, wow, how much better this is to like just be with my friends on a real high vibration, sharing each other and going deep with each other and listening to music. And I remember I had a mushroom trip.
When was that, like in college?
This is my junior year in college. So I had this really important mushroom trip. It's my first, pretty much my first one. And the long answer to why I wanted to decriminalize mushrooms. But in this experience, I just remember looking at my arm and saying, like, whoa, what does it mean at a quantum level? I'm not different from the world. You know, at a quantum level, I'm just in one continuum. And when I eat and poop, it's like a river of energy. The world's pouring through me. You know, I'm one with the world, and the world is alive. And I'm, you know, it's like a way bigger self is going on than just me. And that was just a really important experience to have in college. But I still, you know, was still trying to figure things out. And then, I guess, after college, had a Euro pass, went to London and then Amsterdam.
To Amsterdam, yeah.
And then in Amsterdam, yeah, just intersected the Cannabis Cup. And this is 95, so this is the whole epicenter of the cannabis movement is in Amsterdam.
Yeah, sure.
In 1996, Prop 215 passed, the Medical Marijuana Act in California, and a lot of people moved back to California. But in 95, 96, I mean, just intersected like a perfect storm of just a lot of amazing people and met in my squat. So I was there in a hostel, and then I was like, I don't want to leave Amsterdam. So I ended up going to the squat hotel, and pretty much got adopted by the squat.
And so squat means like people who just live there, and just to explain it for some people who might never heard of it.
Yeah, like, so Amsterdam's got this enlightened policy, or at least did, of that, you know, why have homeless people if you got all this vacant real estate? And basically, if whoever owns the property is just speculating on it and isn't doing anything with it and can't demonstrate that they got some kind of plan within 12 months, it can be legally squatted. And so there's a process. You go into an empty vacant building, they, you know, the owner lawyers up, you lawyer up, there's like, you know, like a 3-day process to figure out whether or not it's squattable. And if it is, you get to be there for, you know, however long. And
how long it takes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just really amazing. And so I was in a squat hotel, and there's like squat saunas or squat, all kinds of cool stuff, very artistic, international activists, artists, and it was just, you know, and for me coming from America, I mean, I was just like, you know, it was so open and tolerant, you know, not only on cannabis policy, but, you know, sexuality, gender, just on so many levels, it was being really opened. And, but in my squat were a couple of individuals from a church called Our Church that was formed in Arkansas in 1993 with cannabis as a sacrament, as a First Amendment religious challenge, constitutional challenge to cannabis prohibition. And the feds, you know, I don't know how many people understand what Arkansas is like now, but let alone in 1993, but not the place to try this. Anyways, they got busted up, and they were facing 10 years to life.
Wow.
You know, if they set foot back in the U.S., and for me, it was just going through this huge awakening of, like, you know, I knew cannabis was important, but just, wow, man, like, yeah, it is a sacrament. It does help us be our more high vibration, awesome selves, and, you know, disinvest from the whatever, you know, dumb moods and lower level, whatever preoccupations, and just helps us get into a higher state and mode. And just really realizing that the drug war, in an important respect, was a religious war on the sacrament of my people, and that that cannabis prohibition was first of all a racist proxy to go after Mexican and African Americans back in the 30s, and then became a proxy to go after the counterculture, and, you know, basically as a, you know, the way for the authorities to, you know, go after the dissidents. And so just really, that was my huge political awakening and religious spiritual awakening. And in and then I was in a gay trans club on acid and E, just going through huge experiences of, like, questioning of self, you know, just all the kind of homophobic, sexist, all the whatever stuff, and just, you know, I'm not gay, I'm not straight, I'm not man, I'm not woman, I'm an incarnate soul here to get
that
down.
That wasn't just one club night where you had this first, let's say, encounter with, like, a bigger...
With the divine, yeah.
Divine.
I mean just really getting down and deep and dying to, I don't want to be this petty, stupid, whatever self. I want to, you know, I want to live and serve and love, and, you know. I mean, one of them was my then partner. I had realized in the course of this night that how jealous I was of her adventures in Asia. She'd taken 9 months and had all these erotic and intense and, you know, just amazing.
But I hope you don't mind, but I think it's a very interesting topic, that because there was just this book that came out, how's it called? Love Drugs, The Chemical Future of Relationships. The interesting thing right now is that it borders and affects so many kind of like faces and like the parts of life also love if it comes to psychedelics. So it's not your only your personal experience, and then you come back home and it's like still your personal experience, nothing will happen. So it suddenly starts to change your whole system, right? I mean, even if you want it or not.
But that was, you know, these experiences. And my final test on that one was actually I met this gay prostitute. You know, we were hitting a coffee shop, and he had been trafficked as a kid, and you know, but we really just kind of hit it off. And he was a cool guy, and he in the club, she was cross-dressed and hot and coming up, and you know, and I just had this mega experience. You know, I'm like, whoa, okay, well, I'm gonna be with Chris now. I don't need to deal with this, you know. And then I was in the hole, you know, I was in this hot, cold game with Spirit World, and you know, the wrong answer, dude. And you know, and it's like, you know, it's like, dude, why would you not be down with anybody, you know, just coming to you to like just be awesome and embrace and have fun and just, you know, be incredible, and you know, what's your problem, you know, and just and open your heart, and boom, again into the light, just blew up again. Which also again was like me, and later just, you know, nothing happened between me and Elena. You know, a lot of this was just my internal dynamics going
on. Sure,
yeah. But ultimately was about me embracing myself, like these, like more, you know, like the gender straight jacket that, you know, the you know, don't be gay, don't be girly, just it fucks up everybody. And like that, you know, just really realizing the, you know, gender fluidity that I have, and that just, so, you know, these whole dimensions of ourselves are like warped. Like we look at like foot binding in China, you see these videos like, oh man, that's like some fucked up barbaric shit that they did over there. But that's like metaphorically, this is what we do, like what we do to our kids, like with all this, all the gender straitjacket, and you know, you're like this, and all these energies of self are, you know, you become ashamed and you get all warped up. And but when they release, there's this mega energy that releases, and that's what happened basically. It was like just, you know, just, and it was this mega kundalini just blowing me open. And
Did you combine it with kundalini yoga?
No.
Or did you do it at this time very intensively already? Because I feel it's kind of a preparation for a psychedelic experience.
Yeah, already. No, man. The basic answer to that is no. And I, you know, and I was basically, and because of it, I wasn't ready. So I was basically in a classical spiritual emergency, like Christina Stanislav Grof wrote a book called Spiritual Emergency.
What is that? Can you talk about that a little bit?
When you're like through whatever. I mean, Christina Grof, it was through the birth of her child. It was just thrown into this complete ecstatic unity experience, but was kind of not prepared to deal with it. It was like borderline schizophrenic for a while, just like taking and needing to do a lot of work to integrate the experience, and that. Like some that our Western clinical model would diagnose, like I had a lot of symptomology of, like, in a way, like paranoid schizophrenia, not in any way that would, I didn't, could totally carry on with my life, but I was just having to work out a lot of stuff because my whole world had been shattered. And and anyway, so yeah, I had to like really start to, you know, I was like born again in a way, and very vulnerable, and the energies that were, you know, like these kundalini energies were just, you know, I guess I wasn't ready for it. And it was just like a lot to, you know. So, but I did intensive journaling, and so the story goes, I like moved back to the States, sold all my stuff, moved back to Amsterdam to grow plants. I became, you know, I was like, announced to my parents, you know, like, the, you know, the drug war is a religious war on the people. If everyone stands up, we're going to end this thing. That's what I'm going to dedicate my life to doing. And I also said, in my squat, these guys were vegetarian, and they asked me, oh, yeah, why are you eating meat? And, you know, and I was in a wide open place. So I'm like, oh, yeah, why am I doing that? And, you know, just went up, smoked a bowl, and, like, just saw I have a knife in the store, and I can shut, you know, here's a cow, and I can shut my empathy down and kill it. And, you know, it's possible for sure. But I could be in a loving relationship, like, with my dog. And, you know, that could also be the case. So, you know, why would I kill it? You know, why don't you just go live your life and I'll just eat vegetables? So, like, real So I came back, mm-hmm. and in a way, being vegetarian was more of a issue for my parents and me moving to grow plants, because that's like a very personal thing. Because my, I grew up barbecuing, my dad, my mom's all the, you know, all the love she fed me, you know, and it's a hard thing for when that happens. But anyways, just a huge part of my life. But things didn't quite work out in Amsterdam. I moved back to Boston to be with my Chris, and we would eventually get married, because she got pregnant and miscarried. But I was a mental health counselor in the Boston Waltham area for paranoid schizophrenic populations, and was really, really good at it, mostly because of these experiences. But it gave me a lot of time to journal and read.
So you mean, yeah. Because you had these very specific experiences in Amsterdam, and on your first kind of psychedelic experience, made you basically more open and more kind of compassionate as a therapist? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and that I knew that, you know, I understood, like, where, you know, the paranoid delusion, like, world, like, you know, just, like, where I was at, was, you know, it was temporary, mm-hmm. and within which it was life and death, and just incredible initiation of mm-hmm. soul and spirit went down. But realizing, well, these guys are just caught. They're just kind of caught. And, you know, but being able to, like, you know, sit with them and hold the space and talk them, you know, hey, if I see them, like, looping, you know, just kind of try to get them out of that, you know.
Sure, yeah.
Well, loop and stuff. And Reagan had gutted the mental health system, so people with no basically relevant qualifications, including me, were making up half the staff hours. But, you know, but I, you know, it was actually an incredible part of my life, and I did that for a year and a half, journaling and reading, just like Stanislav Grof. Like, I had no interpretive mm-hmm. framework whatsoever mm-hmm. for what had happened. You know, I was like, what? I have way more access to that experience now than I did, you know, for the first, like, year. I was like, you know, what the hell did, you know, happen? And so, yeah, but that book, Spiritual Emergence, was a key one. And it was basically pretty much, I was a classical case of that, you know, having a mega, mega experience, like, when you're not ready, basically. And
yeah, can see, you know, that.
But it was what set me on my path. Mm-hmm. And
to also, and in terms of how you were thinking towards, like, how the company could be involved in let's
right.
say this.
Okay, so
endeavor.
Right. So, you know, my relevant decision in Amsterdam was I didn't want to have anything to do with my family company. I was going to grow plants. I was going to do that. Mm-hmm. But then coming back as a mental health counselor, just, you know, and then Chris, we got pregnant again. You know, and I was just having to grow, and I was just journaling a lot, and I was just like, so I was saying that, you know, I was just really growing and maturing and deepening, and gotten to a point, and, you know, had really appreciated what my granddad was all about. And was, you know, got to a point where it's like, man, if a company like Dr. Bronner were to offer me a job, I'd go for it in a second. And, you know, and I got to a point where I was ready to work for my dad. And, you know, like, initially I'd wanted to do my own thing, but I was realizing, no, this is an amazing opportunity. And I let my dad know that I was ready to come in right around when Maya was born. So Maya was born on March 7th, 1997, and same day that Dr. Bronner died. So, you know, just high-fiving in and out. And my dad was shortly after diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. So fortunately, I'd made the decision to come back into the company, you know, before that, and then had a very intense, amazing year with him, where he's, like, really downloading the ropes. And he lived to see my sister marry my brother-in-law, Michael Milam, who's now my sister, Lisa Bronner, who has an amazing blog, Going Green with the Bronner. Going Green with the Bronner Moment? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. And Michael Milam's our our chief operations officer, and just an amazing man. So my dad lived to see them married, and that was his goal on June 6th of 1998, and on June 12th, he died. Just an amazing man. And that was my Uncle Ralph's, his brother's birthday. I had to step up real young. I was like 24, 20, just turned 25 mm-hmm. maybe. But I had vowed that, you know, coming to the company, that I was going to run it as an activist engine, just like my granddad and my dad. And my dad and mom, right before my dad passed, and my Uncle Ralph organized the donation of what was effectively one-third of our entire worth that was in the form of 1,000 acres of land and donated to the Boys and Girls Club of San Diego. And all of our advisors like, don't do that. You got huge estate taxes from my granddad. And like, that's a really bad move. And my dad just, and my mom, you know, like, we're doing this. And it really set the example that, you know, if we can at all afford to help make the world better in whatever way, that's what we're going to do. And that gift was symbolic too of like, kind of like the, you know, who were those beautiful mentors for my dad. Mm-hmm. That he loved like these youth programs and had some important male mentors that weren't his dad that really helped him. And so like giving, you know, to the Boys and Girls Club was like a full circle. And my granddad, you know, he had ovens of the Holocaust and he was doing the best he could, you know, and just, but yeah, you know.
So
just,
you're saying he survived?
Okay. His parents. So he was not, he came over in 29.
Right. Okay. So that's that. Okay,
yeah.
That's
him. Okay. But just, you know, just
but his parents.
His parents. Okay. His, in just a way, my granddad maybe wasn't the best dad, but you know, was just dealing with just immense tragedy.
So now you come in as a young guy in the company, and you had certain experiences. So, how would you say have your, let's say, your very intense psychedelic experience in Amsterdam? How has that kind of affected your, let's say, leadership from very early on, probably?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to say that my dad was really good about, like, son, I know you've had some real spiritual experiences, but you need to humble yourself. And, you know, it's like, what's the most important thing in this company? And, you know, I'm like, oh, I don't know, the customers, our soap. He's like, no, it's our employees. And like mostly a Mexican American workforce, and just really just appreciating like, yeah, you're right. You know, I had this vision. Oh, I'm going to move in all these like who knows what kind of spiritual, quote unquote, people, and whatever, dude. It was like it's such stupid thinking and whatever. It was like just had to go through a real humbling, you know, mm-hmm. process those experiences fully informed, you know, my activism. And so, I mean, I shared that, you know, not only passionate about ending the drug war and integrating our psychedelic allies as fast as possible, but waking up to the disaster of Western consumption and civilization on the planet. It's like a comet's hitting the planet, the sixth great extinction event, ecosystems in collapse, communities being destroyed to feed this like rapacious machine of our industrialized economy, you know, like the, and seeing that the malaise of the Western way is like at heart, like there's this hollow emptiness that we're just trying to feed with consumer goods and domination. And, And so dedicated, like, you know, how are we going to like, you know, make the world better? How are we going to wake people up? How do we shift people's consciousness? And, you know, and activate in different ways. So leveraging the company as a social and progressive engine to drive positive change. And one of the first things we did is implement a 5-to-1 compensation cap. So nobody in our family makes 5 times more than our lowest paid warehouse position. And that all profits not needed for the development of the business go to the causes and charities we support. So that is, you know, like youth programs for sure, animal welfare. We donate to a lot of different farm animal welfare organizations and vegan and vegetarian advocacy organizations, mm-hmm. Organic, regenerative soil. You know, how do we farm? How do we make our farming ecosystems replicate a natural ecosystem, which is self-regenerating? There is no external chemical inputs. 1/3 of the Earth's surface is under industrial agricultural mismanagement. You know, it's all chemical fertilizers and pesticides. It's destroying the ecosystems and just disrupting communities around the world. But if you can farm in a regenerative, organic way, you know, without chemicals, but with just smart, knowledge-intensive crop rotations and intercropping and perimeter plantings for pollinators and predator insects to control your pests and weed pressure and you know, just really activating on a lot of, you know, what are the big solutions that we need to be doing and mm-hmm. leveraging our own supply chains to make sure that, you know, understanding that business, as much as it's whatever you're doing in your head office, is important. Like, your supply chains has got way more impact, 10 times more people involved, all the farmers, all the workers that are growing the coconuts and olives and the palm that are supplying our soaps. You know, who are they? How are they being treated? How are they taking care of their land? And realizing that we were buying oil from brokers on price and spec like everybody else does, and having no visibility or transparency to how those are being grown and processed. And that's this race to the bottom around the world, where corporations go in and, you know, put in plantations and countries with really lax environmental and social standards. Mm-hmm. So like palm oil, palm plantations in Indonesia and Borneo, like just ripping up the rainforest and wetlands, dislocating communities, forcing smallholders off their land who become, you know, basically plantation workers for slave wages. Mm-hmm. And orangutan habitat being destroyed. You know, like how, you know, like not being conscious about how you're purchasing your material, and the same thing with diet. You know, your plate's a farm, and your fork's a pitchfork, and your knife's a butchery knife. You know, what does your farm look like? You know, are you supporting a farmer who's taking care of his land and taking care of his people, and any livestock, or leading a humane life and a quick humane death, or are you, you know, offloading to the machine that's just mm-hmm. ripping the planet apart? And you know, and that's just what people default to and companies default to. So after a tsunami hit Sri Lanka, we had Gerald Lassone, our German-born ace. We'd come together on hemp fiber we put hemp seed oil into the soap. It's one of the first activist things we did. Got in a big fight with the DEA over import of hemp seed oil, which we eventually won. But when the tsunami hit, you know, we were like, you know, Garo, we want to go fair trade anyway. We want to know who our farmers are. And Sri Lanka's got amazing coconut industry. Let's partner with all these coconut farmers. And so one thing led to another, and we set up a fair trade regenerative organic operation in Sri Lanka to supply our coconut oil. We have a really cool project in Ghana for our palm oil. Smallholders there intercropping with cocoa, banana, and cassava. Cocoa and palm are two of the worst crops in monoculture on the planet. Mm-hmm. You know, cocoa's got like literally, child slavery involved. But we're showing that when you do a dynamic interplanting, what's called dynamic ag forestry or multi-strata ag forestry, you look at a natural ecosystem, you've got tall trees, mid-level trees, and ground cover. Mm-hmm. When you take that and you intercrop complementary species in the right understanding how the canopies fill in, that you'll double the yield than in monocultures. You'll minimize weed and pest pressure. The biomass yield, the farmer incomes are way up. You're sequestering huge amounts of carbon into the earth. So we activated on that. For me, it's like, okay, well, these are like the solutions, but how do you get the shift in consciousness to get people to really care about this? And that for me is really the psychedelic integration project.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. That came basically a long time ago out of your early experience, and it kind of materializes like, let's say, 10, 15 years later, which is super interesting, right? But yeah. I mean, and how did you get involved with MAPS then?
Hemp was our initial activist mm-hmm. fight, and that's like how me and Ryan met, and a lot of mm-hmm. our key upper management bronners came together around this big fight on hemp. And hemp was at the nexus of drug policy reform, the most ridiculous example of an out-of-control drug war that was making a non-drug agricultural crop a Schedule I substance, and a really good sustainable crop for sustainable agriculture. And like I was just talking mm-hmm. about, hemp grows like a weed. You don't need a whole bunch of synthetics. And in a regenerative organic system, it's good to have a crop that can outcompete weeds and reduce the weed pressure for subsequent crops. So hemp was well-positioned. But it was really a way to get some body blows in on the drug war machine initially as well. So we were fought, and actually we had two big court victories in the Ninth Circuit Court on Bob Marley's birthday, February 6, 2002, and February 6, 2004.
February 6, really?
Yeah. So two, and then in parallel, we were supporting medical marijuana mm-hmm. and in California, and all the big fight of implementing that. But just also appreciating Rick from afar and MAPS work, and they were trying to break the government monopoly on marijuana that El Soli runs at the University of Mississippi, this like really crappy weed that like that's the only approved weed for any studies, and it was just this crap. And Rick was trying to break that monopoly. Mm-hmm. And so I met Rick at Burning Man in 2005. Mm-hmm. I came to Burning Man, and I'm like, oh wow, MAPS is here. So I went over and I got this download at the MAPS Dome. They're doing these kind of speaker series, and and a panel of ladies was talking about Sanctuary. And Sanctuary, and is now Zendo, but Sanctuary at the time was a safe space where basically if you're having an overwhelming psychedelic experience on the playa, it's a pretty intense environment, and you know it's going to be really amazing, but it can also be really overwhelming.
Yeah, sure, of course. Yeah,
people can have just a lot of shit come up on them, yeah. and you know, having to go to a med tent or have, you know, that is like the worst possible like environment. But Sanctuary is basically a safe space where sitters, just kind of create a nice, safe, quiet space. Come in, just kind of calm you down, kind of hold the space, and just help you like navigate and, you know, through this really difficult material that may be coming up, whatever traumatic stuff, and just really help people do like amazing work. And so I learned all about Sanctuary, and then I introduced myself to Rick after. I'm like, hey Rick, you know, I'm David and doing all this stuff on hemp, but my real goal here is LSD, you know, and someday I'm gonna help you. And that was my joke, like back in the day, like when a reporter would call and say, isn't hemp a stalking horse for marijuana? And like the official answer is like, no, well, I mean, some of us support that, but a lot of us are conservative farmers, and you know, hemp's about nutritious seed and fiber and, you know, blah blah blah. But the secret answer was, no, get it right, it's about LSD. But anyways, so that so now we can joke about that freely.
Yeah.
But anyway, so just met Rick, and we like had an amazing connection. And then that night, we went out, you know, we all dosed in and went out on a big adventure. And one of our campmates actually took a mushroom truffle, which she shouldn't have been doing because she was on some kind of antibiotic or something. And so like a half hour out, she's just not doing well at all. And I'm like, okay, I just heard about Sanctuary. We got to take her to Sanctuary. So we get all the way over to Sanctuary. It's like a half mile, you know, she's like dead weight. I'm like, oh my gosh. And get to Sanctuary, and I meet Rick again. And this time it's in his therapist role, which, you know, Rick, he one day wants to be a psychedelic therapist. You know, MAPS is just, you know, his career, one day he wants to be a psychedelic therapist.
So just in case some people might not know him, so he's the founder of MAPS, and now he's basically the most important person for psychedelic.
Yeah, so
introducing psychedelic therapy.
Yeah, Rick. Saying, Rick's, yeah. Yeah, he's, you know, he's got the, you know, the trauma of the Holocaust, generational, really driving him.
Yeah.
You know, like we want peace on earth, and he, like me, sees like integrating our psychedelic allies as the most important thing we can possibly do to like heal people up, heal the traumas, you know, break the depression, get people healed up and loving each other. And
so back to the Sanctuary. We want to hear that story.
So I got to meet Rick again, and he's now his therapist. You know, I met him as head of MAPS. Now I meet him as therapist, Rick the therapist, and he's so beautiful. And you know, he's like, yeah, bring her in, and we like lay my friend down, and you know, he gets her a bucket, and she's like, you know, pukes, and you know, but he's just calming her down, and we're all holding space, like super vibrating, you know, on the L, just like, but it's like beautiful. And like, I remember giving my friend like this big hug. And Rick's like, yeah, you know, you guys can leave. Just come back in the morning and come get your friend. So, you know, we go out and have all this big adventure. And the next morning, I come and get my friend. And she's just like, oh, my God, Rick's an angel. You know, it was the most amazing experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm just realizing the power of having, like, what can be just a really traumatic, difficult experience. Like, you know, creating these spaces where, you know, that, you know, you can just process that and just really navigate to a really successful outcome. So it was this beautiful introduction to Rick and to MAPS in both that policy advocacy of like integrating our allies and as a therapist, you know, in this harm reduction space. So really powerful initial meeting with Rick. And, you know, and then as, you know, a company, so, you know, I covered some of our different issue areas, but, you know, more or less like a quarter of our philanthropic efforts is in terms of drug policy reform of one sort or another. So industrial hemp was important, but now we've won that. Medical marijuana was a big front, pretty much winning that. We're ending cannabis prohibition. We've been involved in most of the state fights. And I joined MAPS in 2015. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to by Rick when Ashana Haley. So Ashana was a transgendered rock star, amazing person who had founded some kind of high tech company and sold it, and made a lot of money. And MDMA really helped her find her truth. And she was a board member on MAPS and really strategic and really helping Rick and John Gilmore, who's like the number three at Sun Microsystems and another like really strategic high level cat. They were kind of like, you know, the heart of MAPS. So when she died, Rick invited me on to fill her shoes, and she left $5 million to MAPS in her will. And so yeah, it was just an amazing, you know, opportunity really to help Rick rock the most important project I feel in the world, which is integrating our allies as fast as possible. And we've pledged, my family has pledged $1 million a year for 5 years to help move MDMA through FDA approval process mm-hmm. for treatment-resistant PTSD.
Which is pretty much happening now, right?
I mean, yeah, we're in phase three and very successful. It should be approved in 2022. And, you know, Rick kind of, you know, MDMA in a way is like, has the least baggage, and then you're healing up the trauma of veterans especially, but, you know, basically choosing, a medicine and a condition where like no other pharma approach or therapeutic approach is really getting at the problem of these really traumatized people, you know, whether it's rape victims or soldiers in combat. You know, when you have that severe PTSD, like you just, you know, without having MDMA or some other psychedelic medicine involved to help you really get in there and process really hard, difficult experiences and emotions, it's almost like open heart surgery without an anesthetic. You mm-hmm. know, it's like you just mm-hmm. need the medicine, just really helps. And, you know, and so Rick very strategically identified MDMA and PTSD as like, this is what we're going to break it open with. So, and it's also poetic and kind of healing up the trauma of soldiers, like the countercultural split, you know, healing up the trauma of the soldiers and that whole cultural split of the 60s in a way is, you know, kind of being healed. And like we have so many veteran advocates, you know, veterans are committing suicide at the rate of 22 people a day, way more than actually been lost in combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it's completely solvable. I mean, not that we'll save every one of them, but most of them with MDMA therapy, with ayahuasca, with their plant medicines. I mean, these indigenous ways of healing ourselves and relating to each other and being in the world, like that's the answer to these huge epidemics of depression and anxiety and addiction and, you know, the core problems of the Western disease mm-hmm. is these medicines that are, you know, when they're approached with intention and respect and you know, you're with a trained facilitator who can really help you, you know.
So, I mean, you mentioned earlier when you met Rick, and he also obviously got involved because of his, let's say, Holocaust journey or mm-hmm. trauma from his family. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in what way do you think this might be, if there's more approval, basically a really probably very popular tool to kind of help sometimes the generation after? It's often a generation that's kind of surpassed, and that the children of survivors are sometimes not really affected, but then the grandchildren of survivors, for example, are very much affected through depression or kind of all kinds of, let's say, I'm not going to say mental health, but kind of problems, but just several different traumas, maybe, without going into detail now. But so do you think this could become, in the end, like a real specific tool to erase the Holocaust trauma, at least? Not, of course, the remembering the Holocaust, but the trauma?
Yeah, I think not just Holocaust, but all the traumas that are ricocheting down to generations. I mean, slavery and colonialism and just all kinds of traumatized communities, populations. Absolutely. And in my experience, I can share my story actually today was just visiting our ancestral home in Heilbronn and our factory there. And our factory, you know, the Nazi who got it for one Deutschmark and sold it to the Frank family in the late 40s. And Frank family is a multi-generational rad family making die casting metal parts for like high tech and automobiles and stuff. And Nicky Frank's rad, and he's now running the business, and I just had lunch with him. He's just an awesome cat. But I was just visiting ancestral home and introducing my partner Mia to my ancestors there, and yeah, absolutely. So this time though, there's a cemetery. I'm going to kind of tell a story, and it relates to its generational trauma processing with medicine. And it begins with, I'll just begin at Burning Man. So,
everything begins at Burning Man.
Well, so yeah. What we do is when I was about 10 years ago going through a real tough time, I was asking my dad, I'm like, Pop, he'd been dead for 10 years, in a way our relationship had deepened since. And I was like, Pop, how'd you do it? How'd you, raise a family and run a business? I was just like really struggling. And I remember the joy of foam that we had brought the world. Like it was just, this ecstatic experience. And because when he died, it was just overwhelming. We had to shut down that business. We sold it off to another special effects house, just concentrated on Bronner's. But I was just remembering how much joy we brought and what a magician he was making these contraptions to make foam and just how much fun we had just opening up a fire hose of foam on the world. And it's just this ecstatic, beautiful experience. And so I built a foam machine based on one of his late designs for a German owned Sri Lankan hotel, actually, and brought it to Burning Man. And was clearing out blocks of people. We're like, what the hell? And we're just blasting foam. And actually did the most cardinal sin at the burn, which is leave no trace. Like we were just, people were bringing us water, and we were just blasting them with foam, and made an acre of turquoise water from all the body paint. Wow. Which is the number one thing you're not supposed to do at Burning Man. But that was the birth of the foam. So fast forward to 2013. We went real big, and now we have containers, plexiglass containers that contain the gray water, and there's no more spillage, and very popular camp to come and get, blasted with foam, and it's super fun. We got DJs, it's amazing. And we're the host camp for Zendo as well. And what happened is some of our Jewish guests, especially this one lady, rather than really experiencing the joy of the whole, moment, just get triggered generationally, and then being packed into the plexiglass trailer, the triggering the Nazis, giving the soap and the towel to the Jewish victims, getting them, pacifying them into the gas chambers, and then
because they wanted the impression, they get a shower, kind of.
Yeah, just seeing people being masked, hurt, and all the screaming and yelling, that's all ecstatic and beautiful. They're just hearing it. They're going way the other direction. And
interesting.
And so this lady who founded this Jewish theme camp, Milk and Honey, they do a Seder out at the burn. Allie, I forget her last name, but Allie wrote this amazing essay called Seifa. And it was a play on the German word for soap and how unsafe she felt in this experience, and reached out to contact me. He's like, hey, I just wrote this thing. I had this experience. And I was like, whoa, well, here's my, lineage, I've got the Holocaust, directly in my history, and my dad developed firefighting foam, and it's amazing, and I'm honoring my granddad and my dad bringing together this joyous thing, but oh my gosh, and that year we came to Heilbronn, and it was one of the first times, or that's the first time I went into the old home and saw the bronze plaques and got in touch with Bertolt and Francisca, and then feeling my granddad and my great aunts playing in the streets as kids, and the enormity of the tragedy, as things just started going sideways. And I went around the corner, and there was this park, and I go, whoa, it's so beautiful. I feel drawn to it, and it's a cemetery. And I'm like, whoa. And I feel, and there's this feeling of the dead saluting the dead, just the Germans saluting their Jewish brothers and sisters, this feeling of solidarity and salute. And I'm feeling most of these were Nazis. They're just kids, just fucking slaughtered in this conflagration that engulfed the world of World War II, and just this huge, this generational slaughter, and around in Europe and Asia and everywhere. And then just feeling the life force coming forward to all of us, that karmic inheritance, you bear, the generation bears and inherits and tries to vibrate it up and passes it on with all the trauma that they didn't process, and maybe some new trauma, but hopefully overall it's getting better. And just feeling that coming forward, And so for the burn that year, there's the following burn. So I tell Ali, like, yeah, you know, this is how it'll do. I took a picture of the plaque of the stumble stones with the mm-hmm. you know, date of birth, date of deportation, mm-hmm. date of death. For
where they died, also where?
Yeah, also where it's the Riesenstadt and Auschwitz. And made a picture, and we made a sign that said, you know, to our Jewish guests, who may be experiencing any form of generational trauma, we hold you in our hearts until you move through to the moment, present moment of celebration, l'chaim. You know, made like a nice sign just to, like, but not like wanting to trigger it. You know, like we want to acknowledge it, but not like trigger it if you're not thinking about it. You know, so it was this kind of delicate dance. So Ali came up, it was like Wednesday of the burn, it's a new moon. And me and Mia just dosed in like an hour prior, and Ali's like comes up. He's like, hey, you know, yeah, I want to check it out, what you got going on. And this was a year we were celebrating Albert Hoffman and it was actually Reformation. So every year we have a different theme. So Reformation, we always put foam in our name, so it changes every year. Mm-hmm. So Reformation, because the theme was Da Vinci. So we were the, you know, everyone's going to do Renaissance stuff, but we were the Reformation. And
okay.
The Reformation, like we were celebrating Albert as a modern day Da Vinci.
Interesting.
You know, I was going to figure out some way to get psychedelic in it.
Obviously.
And, but, you know, a mystic chemist who's like mm-hmm. just so beautiful and amazing. And in the last chapter of his book, LSD, My Problem Child, is just amazing. And it's about that alienation, disconnection from the world of the modern Western ego, and that the Greeks had the solution with the mysteries of Eleusis, and you mm-hmm. had this initiation that would restore the connection.
Well, this topic, it's so interesting you mentioned that, because this is so coming back right now, that a lot of kind of, let's say, the classic European culture that the European culture is based on, like the Greek culture, mm-hmm. is actually related to psychedelic potions. And I mean, I cannot imagine when I ever heard this, and that, like, going to school or kind of studying anything. This is just really, and I mean, like, Aristoteles, I think we had this, that in the other podcast, he's even writing about this, like how he kind of experienced that, to experience kind of life and death, and then write about it afterwards. So, which has a really big contribution to any kind of big cultural work coming out of Greek philosophy, basically.
Yeah, right, because all the playwrights, all the philosophers, everyone, I mean, all the major figures were initiates of Eleusis, and, you know, even slaves could be initiates, and the only ones forbidden were murderers, those who committed murder, and even they could be initiated if they went through certain purification rites. Okay. And so, and just, I guess, for everyone who doesn't know, for your audience, the mysteries of Eleusis, so our word for mysticism comes from the mystes, those who have been initiated into the rites of Eleusis and are forbidden to speak of what they've seen. But we have these indirect accounts from, like, you know, from early Greek antiquity, like pre-classical Greece, in the late Roman antiquity, mm-hmm. the mysteries operated for over 2,000 years. And like Cicero, like, wrote, you know, blessed are they who have you know, been initiated, for they have seen the source of life in its end and are reconciled to the, you know, the source. And there's like these different indirect accounts of this rite, and it was built around the Demeter Persephone. The Demeter Persephone myth was the main architecture, and, you know, Demeter as the mother goddess, and Persephone as like her daughter, grain goddess, kidnapped by Hades into the underworld, and you know, the whole world's in famine, and Demeter's grieving, the whole world's in famine. Zeus intercedes with Hades, all right, you got to give her up. And this is kind of the patriarchal version of the myth. But then tricks Persephone eating six pomegranate seeds. And so Persephone is reunited with her mother, you know, it's spring, it's glorious. But then she has to spend 6 months of the year in the underworld. And that's like, on one superficial level, it's the explanation of the seasons. But on the way deeper level, that, like, Albert Hoffman was like getting at, and like, why was this so important? That, you know, Persephone was, you know, it was the choice. It was a choice to self-sacrifice, to regenerate the world, and it was her choice. And it's very, I think, related to the Jesus Jehovah, you know, myth. Very similar mm-hmm. architecture of, like, you know, Jesus swallowed by the world of sin, wow. his love sacrifices and regenerates the world. It's an archetypal truth in reality, mm-hmm. of the deep mysteries of life and death and rebirth and love. And so this experience was kind of reliably precipitated in ancient Greek times. And this was the kind of solution to this, like, disconnected ego, like, you know, looking at matter formally, you know, like cutting it up and exploiting it and not realizing it's living and more one with it. And, you know, like overcoming that disconnection. But yeah, so anyway, so I definitely feel that the medicines can really help process trauma from, you know, this life and then prior generations, and just that, because that ricocheting, that trauma ricocheting down the generations, especially the male aggression that's just fucking up the world, you know, that's what we need to heal up. And, you know, like the fathers punishing the sons and who in turn punished the sons. And, you know, I love working with Michael Pollan, calls him Fritz. So he's German-American. Okay. And he's an amazing cat.
Who's Fritz?
Yeah, you know, we'll call him Fritz.
Okay.
But he's an amazing German-American who's a high-level shaman. He's an initiate of he's taking a bodhisattva vow in I forget which Zen tradition, but a high-level medicine worker who's worked with a lot of us. Mm-hmm. And he healed up some deep rage. You know, he had this huge rage from his Nazi father just, like, fucking, you know, on him. He healed it up. And he's just, you know, so, yeah, healing up that trauma is a key part of what these medicines can do. And Holocaust trauma and colonialism of all kinds and slavery and just the drip, drip, drip of constant racism and patriarchal, homophobic, sexist shit that people deal with, you know, and both the perpetrators and the victims, you know, the perpetrators, like what I realized in that experience in Amsterdam was what I was doing was I was doing it myself. Like, you know, everything you're doing to someone else, oneness is the truth. And whatever you're doing to somebody else, you're doing it to yourself. You know, like that's just the truth. So, yeah, so these medicines, it's about healing up all of us. And I'm involved in a campaign in Oregon called the Psilocybin Service Initiative.
Yeah, that's an interesting.
And the husband, wife, Thomas Schreiker, they work with domestic violence, both perpetrators and victims. That's their work, and Cherie's got the Holocaust in her lineage, and they see the medicine, how important it is to process this trauma. And Carlos Plazola and Larry Norris of Decriminalized Nature. So Carlos healed up, you know, just the mega, you know, trauma from colonialization and just the, you know, all the fucking warped up shit, you know, that, you know, he was able to just on a high dose mushroom journey just liberate himself. And he's all about, you know, decriminalizing. We have a right to these plants that grow on the ground, you know, that, you know, that we don't need pharmaceutical you know, and it's a really powerful new movement, totally down with.
Exactly.
I totally believe in, like, breaking the pharma and going through that route, and it's given us everything in a way, preparing this moment. But now, yeah, decriminalized nature, like, making this amazing case that, like, we should be able to cultivate and grow and gift and use these medicines ourselves, and not everybody can afford therapy. In fact, some of the most in need of therapy are the ones who are not going to be able to afford it. So to be able to grow your own medicine and sit and hold space for each other is very important. So that's
a good connection to the last question. So, I mean, how do you see obviously, like you said, a lot of kind of decriminalization movements are picking up speed right now and everything, but I mean, still, and also, like you said, I said that a lot of people, most people say that it should have, like, a structure, that you have, like, either a therapist guiding you through experiences, and that the so-called set and setting is
set and setting needs to be just as common as drunk driving.
Yeah.
Designated driver. Mm-hmm. You need set and setting.
Do you think this is gonna play out in the next, let's say, couple of years? Because obviously California is just it's gonna happen very soon, or like even other, like, Colorado is already there, so...
Yeah, so it's a good question. So I kind of had this initial skepticism of the decriminalization movement along the lines of, these are very powerful medicines. You can't just, like, drop them into the culture. Like, you know, like, it's, you know, we don't have... like, the therapeutic setting, in a way, is our analog to the indigenous ceremonial container. And, you know, set and setting is so important. And, you know, high-dose psychedelic sessions, like, is being pioneered in John Hopkins and UCLA and NYU, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, it's important that people are properly prepared, that the set and setting is ideal for the really therapeutic, healing, spiritual outcome. And so, yeah, I was initially pretty skeptical. But what I realized is that both in Denver and in Oakland, that hand in hand with decriminalization is a full-blown education effort on set and setting, on proper preparation, proper integration, and that the movement is not just about decriminalizing medicines to go party with. It's all about self-healing. It's Carlos. It's all about healing up the trauma. He's like, look, man, these are the indigenous medicines. The critique, like, oh, this is the white people decriminalizing their drugs. He's like, no, dude, this is the most marginalized communities. Like, these are our indigenous medicines to heal our trauma, and that it's elitist that to say that, because mostly therapists and leaders have their own access outside of the therapeutic model. Sure. And it's like an elitist thing to say, like, oh, you can't handle these medicines, then you need to wait for this, and it's like, no, dude, we can all figure this out. And as a community based, like, we can figure this out. And that's what they're doing. It's like they're actively promoting and creating integration circles and best practices and information. So SPOR is formed in Denver. It's a really great organization from Kevin Matthews and Duffy and that crew. Really cool. And then ERIE, Larry Norris's ERIE, I forget exactly what it stands for, but entheogenic, something, integration. But just doing amazing work on, best practices and, respectful. But putting forward a decriminalized model as, look, these are medicines that are our birthright that can really heal us up in a deep way. And they should not just be locked up in this like kind of therapeutical medical pharma model. So I've come to really respect that movement and have, and actually our director of social action is Adam Eidinger. Also DC based along with Ryan. And Adam was the campaign manager that legalized weed in 2014 in DC, and we were the main financial backers of that. And when you win in DC, you're talking to the local leadership, or your local media is talking to the national leadership. Now we're going to do a decrim nature campaign in DC. So that's underway. We just had like an incredible hearing. We had veterans. We have veterans exploring treatment solutions. Vets is SEAL Team 6. Kind of the elite special forces squad in the U.S. And the special forces are bearing the brunt of modern warfare, and they're just fucking epidemics of trauma and alcoholism, and fucking they're just it's really a horrible situation. But so now they've got like all these special forces getting healed up and just are very powerful advocates for the medicine. We have end of life advocate, like we had a doctor, the physician who heads up the integrative unit of the George Washington Hospital with a submitted testimony. Our main proposer is a lady, Melissa Lavasani, and she healed up, she works in city government, and she healed up severe anti and postpartum depression, like fucking horrible postpartum depression, with ayahuasca and then microdosing psilocybin, just turned it around. I mean, she was spinning, and so many ladies or women suffer from this really, there's so much stigma around all these things, but to have these medicines help with, be accessible for something like postpartum depression, which generally has to survive.
For example, that's true.
So she's our main proposer, and if you go to Decrim Nature DC or Google Decrim Nature DC and Google the press release for this, there's links to all that written testimony. Just amazing to read. So we feel like all these strategies are key. I mean, we're totally committed to the FDA approval route for not only MDMA, but psilocybin, and we support USONA as well. And then the Oregon, what we're doing there is a therapeutic model, but outside of pharma. So basically kind of replicating the same kind of therapist training and that whole model, but making it accessible to all adults without a qualifying diagnosis that, we're all struggling. We all can use the medicine. But bringing that kind of best therapeutic container in practice and having a kind of a program to, like, it's not a training program itself. It's actually a licensing of training programs. But we're saying, we're not saying like one and only one training program is okay, but all the training programs have to meet basic criteria. Like you have to have, whatever. You have to be trained up on indigenous methods. You got to be trained up on the best Western. You know, it's just like you have to have these minimum and you have to put in this many hours under supervision before whatever. And so that the Oregon model is really, really important. And then the decriminalized nature is coming in with like, okay, like, well, therapy is great, but a lot of us can't access that. And we have a right to the medicine and to our own healing. So I think all of these movements are super crucial and important.
Okay. No. Perfect. Thank you so much. It was very, very interesting because it was the first podcast where we really talked about this possible Holocaust subject, which obviously comes up in several different scenarios. Oh. That was very interesting. Thank you. You talked about this.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I wanted to also share that today, you know, went to visit the ancestor home again to introduce my partner Mia, and then went to that same cemetery. And this time, you know, it's the park right around the block. And this time, you know, the last time it was this big, kind of intense generational trauma, you know, but feeling that salute and solidarity of the dead and just the unity of the Germans and the Jews and just the, you know, just that feeling and the feeling of all sides of the conflict that engulfed the world, you know, just the dead in solidarity and with us. All right, you got to go get it. And, but this time it was like, oh, this is their playground. They grew up here playing around, and me and Mia were climbing up on the, I got some pictures here of us climbing up on like the stuff and just feeling them like as kids, as playing, and just really resonating to that, and still also like feeling, of course, the tragedy of it all. But you know, this time just really like, wow, this was where they played, and you know, just really getting in touch with that.
We apologize that we didn't have a proper goodbye with David, but our conversation was so long and so interesting that we had to rush at one point. But I'm sure David will be back on a show very soon with other psychedelic-related topics. So, and as always, if you want to send feedback and let us know what you think about the podcast and anything related to psychedelics, please go on our website, www.thenewhealthclub.de, and email us some feedback. We're very happy to hear from you.